And welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Now, it is time to go to Zoom because we're going to say good morning to Brendan Devenny and preview tonight's DL debate. Brendan, good morning.
Good morning, Dom.
Now, we've had the inter-county season pretty much wrapped up and that's all done and dusted, but we now come into the local championships and the local leagues, and this is where, for the clubs and the parishes right around the county, this is where it starts getting very interesting.
Yeah, that's it, Don. It's all about championship, as we know. I suppose with a split season now, there was to be, you know, more respect given to the club championship in terms of its time, and, you know, you had different teams running through the All-Ireland series and that, and there was a lot of, I suppose, debate on how to get things right. So we have this split season now, we're in the championship. It has left league football a bit of a strange competition. I think it's very much warm-up stuff, you know. There used to be a bit more about the leagues now. There's an odd team, obviously, maybe he's gone up a division, wants to hold their own and that. But by and large, everybody's just waiting for the championship. So it was the start of the first of the round games. There's obviously a draw of two, a home and away game. That's how it kicks off. I don't know, so a lot of teams looking to win that first home game. That was a big part of it in the senior, intermediate and junior. And, of course, ladies football as well at the weekend had championship right across the board as well. So a lot happening.
Joined in studio by Oisin Kelly, well known to everyone here, Brendan Kilcoyne, Ryan Ferry of the Donegal News as well. A heavy-hitting panel for what's going to be a very interesting discussion, I suspect.
Oh, you're talking, Don, yeah, a lot of experience in the room there, definitely. Listen, yeah, Oisin's going to be in this week, which is great to have him there. Pádraig Colford will be in quite a few weeks now coming up as well, but Oisin's going to be there this week too. And he was out and about, of course, he was the Unions game at the weekend doing commentary himself and Brendan Kilcoyne and that. And there were some good performances in there at the weekend, you know, a lot of home teams coming through. Big for you to get your home victory, done, particularly, you know, that first game. You know, there's a lot made of it, you know, and McCool's coming through against Ardragh. Bourne Masters with a big victory over Gidor. Of course, Gidor just in the league final recently and last year's county final as well. So, you know, there's Bourne Masters been building momentum the last couple of years, brilliant underage teams. We were wondering how long it will take to come through. And, of course, it's only the first game. Gidor, of course, lost the first game last year away to Aireux and still made the county final. So, big win for Dunloe away to Glenfinn. St Michael's beating Killy Beggs at home. Say, Aireux accounted for Downing's. And St Noel's were beaten by Glens Foley. Michael Murphy still rolling back the years there for them. And big win for champions Niamh Connell away at Clonmacnoise. So, yeah, listen, the teams that didn't win now, Donald, pressure's on for the second game, and everyone that came through this weekend with a victory, it takes a bit of pressure off them in the senior ranks and the intermediate as well. A couple of big derby games, Milford got the better of Fannett, and Narasa beating Nivora. Narasa coming up from junior. So, yeah, some big games in the intermediate. Termin racking up a big score as well against Niamh Columba. So, yeah, a lot of stuff happening there. Raymond McGee's Buncrana as well had a good victory over the Gaels in the intermediate. So, yeah, interesting stuff happening across the board, though.
But way too early to be making any predictions as to how the championship's going to pan out over the coming weeks. I mean, as you say, some of the heavy hitters perhaps facing initial defeats, but one thing is almost assured, they're going to be bouncing back and they're not going to take this lying down.
That's it. First game can be strange, though, no more than like ourselves and Union's going in. You're just not, like, you have a fair idea what's happening, but until you see game time, it's always a wee bit of a question mark, just how you're going to acquit yourself. And, of course, the way the champions lay it out, you've got opportunities to come back, so no one game will define you until you get into the knockout stages. So, yeah, a lot of assessing to be done. You know, a few teams had a few weeks layoff and that. Could be a bit rusty, lots of injuries you're seeing across teams out there too, fellas coming back and getting back into that. So, listen, people are question marking the championship, don't they? There are too many teams in it, particularly in the senior. You know, you look, probably, listen, I was obviously at the St Union's game at the weekend, you know, not much of a crowd there. I'm just wondering, are people, because of the format of it, waiting for, you know, the crunch games, if you like? You know, championship's about crunch. So while you have this, while you're trying to find the balance of it, you have this kind of build-up to the crunch championship. So, you know, it does really feel like a thing, Donal, until you get there. But listen, we're teasing it out. We're trying to get the right formula. But I think there's possibly too many teams in the senior and too many games.
And the DL debate on tonight, and also DL debate's going to be there every Monday right through the whole process. So, I mean, you know, you can people can track how things are going right through the coming weeks. DL debate's going to be on top of everything. Did you get a chance to watch any of the Camogie yesterday? I presume you didn't get to see too much live if you were in, at the Unions game, but did you get to watch the Sunday game afterwards?
Do you know what? I just seen reports on it there. It looked fantastic. I was listening to bits and pieces of radio. I was going up and down to Guidoor, actually. Mm. That's where I was, hitting the beats. I made the most of it. You probably can't see this hat of a big red red face on me. Mm-hmm. Well, do you know what the ones where you hit the beads, Donald, and you're like, that evening, you're like, how come I wasn't applying a bit of cream?
Yeah.
but I've seen the reports on the Camogie there. Listen, it looked brilliant.
Yeah, there's a few comments in this morning. A lot of people thinking that Cork were lucky and Galway was a bit hard done by with suggestions of a few fouls, and maybe one of the Cork goals was thrown in. And I've no doubt that's going to be discussed again in the future. But Brendan, DL debate, as we said, it's on tonight. It's yourself, Oisín, Brendan Kilcoyle, Ryan Ferry, discussing what happened over the weekend, looking ahead, I'm sure, to the future, and also looking at other GAA news across the board. You had a fairly short summer break, but hey, back with a vengeance.
That's it, Donald. Yeah, we had a wee bank holiday weekend off. That was about the height of it.
We're legit, back really.
But listen, it's great, Donald. Listen, it's something you love. You know, it's not really anything ever that is tasking on you. You know, we love the game of football, and we love promoting the GAA, and say that's why it's called the debate. We love hearing points of view on it, and we'll certainly hear them this evening.
Yep, absolutely. Brendan Devaney, in the meantime, thank you very much indeed. It's on directly after the 7 o'clock news tonight. The DL debate with Brendan and his panel. Always essential listening for anyone with an interest in sport. Now, I want to take a comment. Caller says, can I please say how insulting Donal Kavanagh's reply to that parent's genuine concern around his daughter not getting any playing time at her local club was. Now, if I insulted anyone, I absolutely apologise. That was not my intention. Donal made a joke out of the parents' concern that they took time to contact the show. And was Donal implying this parent's daughter was useless? No, Donal was not in any way implying anyone is useless. Donal told his own story, which was when Donal was growing up and Donal was playing sport, Donal was useless, which he was, and that was the absolute truth. I put forward, I discussed the fact that there is a, coaches have two priorities. The coaches are trying to bring players through on a team, but coaches also want to play the best team they can because they want their club to progress. I certainly wasn't making any discussion or any impugning of anyone. Girls stopping playing sport is a major issue in the early teens, hence why it's advertised nationally. And this issue the parent has highlighted is a major contributor due to clubs having inappropriate coaches only concerned with playing people that they want to play. Would Donald state the coach picks players to win matches if full player participation is the rule and non-competitive? I see the point that you're making. They're saying girls will never develop in any sport if they're not given the opportunity. This is a major issue in both soccer and Gaelic. And in the case of Gaelic, moving clubs isn't an option, but clubs need to ensure that they have coaches who are coaching for the girls' development. Perhaps Donald should ask how many other parents have similar concerns and parents who have daughters no longer playing for clubs due to these practices. I certainly will ask that question, and I stand absolutely corrected. If the point I made was an inappropriate one, I certainly did not mean to insult anyone, and if I did, I unreservedly apologise, and I take it back. That's all I can say. We were speaking earlier on to Joseph Higgins with regards to teachers and the TUI. Caller says, every year from the middle of August to September, teachers realise holidays are up and they have to go back to work. Reality sets in and they complain. I'm sick of teachers. The sick leave of teachers is shocking. They're off for weeks on end. The government needs to be firm and make sure that teachers are working from 9 until 5:30. Teachers must correct their work. Sub-teachers are often unqualified students who are not qualified in education. Now, teachers will tell you that they do work many, many hours and that they go well beyond their recruited hours. That's what they will say to you. Caller says, and this is a comment, in relation to the current protests in Belfast with the contingent from the south, a terrible scorn on the whole island, but there appears to be different agendas in the melting pot. If you look at the interview with the person from the working class, Sandy Rowe, you see 35 years of historic bigoted agenda that's always been evident in areas like this, resurfacing once more in relation to immigrants. In relation to the southern contingent, homelessness, health, education issues are all 100% reasons to have created real unrest. Neither economy can function without immigration of good, honest, decent people. people making a better life for themselves. Here, sometimes I wonder, is it a hangover from the crash, the bailout that maybe should have been protested more at? Now it feels like a second bailout is creating phoenixes out of the ashes of the crash. There are those that feel this is an economy for the few, and that Micheál Martin, previously sitting at the crash cabinet table, is not smirking with them, but at them. All I will say to that caller, and I can see the point you're making. Now, what I would suggest that if you're saying there is a traditional antipathy toward Catholics in a loyalist area like Sandy Row, there is an argument that says what's happening in Coolock at the moment is an identical situation. It's just the blame is shifting. That the reason areas like Sandy Row and areas like Tigers Bay and Belfast and other loyalist enclaves, the problem is, and by the way, the same holds in Catholic areas where there is antipathy toward Protestants. And it's exactly the same thing. And it's this, that in an area like that, there is homelessness, there is unemployment, there is economic deprivation, there are social problems. And the problem is, it gets blamed on the other community. So the fact that traditionally in a loyalist area where there's an antipathy toward Catholics, part of the reason there is that antipathy toward Catholics is that they are blaming Catholics for the situation that they're in. And conversely, Catholics in a nationalist area are blaming Protestants for the economic situation they're in. If you listen to people like Eamon McCann and people like that, Eamon McCann would always have argued that the communities in the Falls and Shankill had far more in common than the communities in, shall we say, the Malone Road and the more affluent areas. And the Protestants in an area like Tigers Bay or Sandy Row had much more in common with nationalists in the Falls than they had with their rich co-religionists on the Malone Road or wherever. That was always something argued by Eamon McCann. In areas like that in Northern Ireland, traditionally, the blame went on the opposite religion. In Coolock, the blame for the exact same sort of conditions is going on immigrants. So the issue is, it's basically, it's what's happening now in Belfast is the shift of blame is changing, but the underlying problems in Sandy Row are the same as the underlying problems in Coolock. And what happens is blame gets cast. And what's now happening is that blame is being cast in the direction of immigrants and people seeking international protection. So I think there are probably two far more similar situations than they may appear at first glance. It's just that traditionally a religion was the cause for blame within Northern Ireland. But it is arguable that the underlying situation, the economic deprivation, etc., in Sandy Row is going to be the same as the economic deprivation in Coolock. And the question isn't whether or not the area is deprived. The question is where the local community is casting blame. And I think that's the issue. Now, joined on Zoom by David Moore from Astronomy Ireland. And David's going to speak to us about what promises to be a very interesting phenomenon in our skies tonight. The Perseid meteor shower, and I hope I've pronounced that right, David, have I?
Perseid? Yes, Perseid. Indeed.
Excellent. Well, that's good. I'm glad about that. 20 times more shooting stars in the sky for the next two nights, thanks to this phenomenon. It promises to be really, really spectacular.
Absolutely, yeah. And this shower itself is known for producing very bright, very fast meteors because we're travelling around the sun at about 67,000 miles an hour. And these particles left over by a comet, they're about the size of a grain of sand, are heading towards us at a similar speed. So the closing speed is of the order of 130,000 miles an hour. And at that speed, something even as small as a grain of sand, when it hits the air 100 kilometres up, will produce a meteor, a fiery streak, that can be seen over the entire island simultaneously. And if we get any bigger particles, say one the size of a pea, that would light up Ireland like daylight for 1 or 2 seconds. I've seen that happen with the Perseid, so a real spectacular celestial fireworks display.
Looking at the weather forecast as given to us for this region by Met Aaron, tonight we're told it'll be dry with clear spells early on, but as the night goes on, cloud will increase, bringing some scattered rain or drizzle. So hopefully there's a chance that we'll see some of it at least tonight. you know, once it goes dark now, it doesn't really get dark yet until about sort of 9:30, 10:00. So from 10 o'clock onwards, hopefully there'll be sufficient clear spells. I mean, how much will cloud, I mean, obviously cloud's going to affect our chances of seeing this. The clearer, the better, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, clear spells, well, I'll take that, because the clouds themselves are typically 1 or 2 kilometres up, but the meteors hit the atmosphere about 100 kilometres up. They don't penetrate down too deep, so even people in high-flying jet aircraft are quite safe. The Earth's atmosphere stops these things dead in their tracks in a fraction of a second. So if there are just clear patches, then look in the clear patches, because they can happen anywhere in the sky. They're called Perseids because they appear to point back to the constellation of Perseus, which is over in the northeast, which you can see them on the opposite side of the sky to that. It's just they will point back to the northeast. So you just, in Ireland, typically we have problems with the weather. And for instance, they would have been quite strong last night. We had all those thunderstorms. Yep. As if it knew there was a meteor shower coming. And there's also a huge display of the northern lights going on right now. And it was on last night as well. And we saw nothing of it because of the weather. But, you know, and if it's cloudy, you know, don't give up. There's always a chance a clear spell will come along. Typical Irish weather.
What is it that's causing this phenomenon to the extent that we can predict to within almost an hour when it's going to start, when it's going to be visible? Is it just atmospheric conditions at the moment? Because it comes and goes on a quasi-regular basis. What is the predictor that allows us say it's going to be tonight?
Yeah, well, the meteors are caused by these bits of dust that have fallen off a comet. Its name is Swift Tuttle, and it was last near the sun in 1992. I remember seeing it myself. It needed a telescope to see it well. And that goes around the sun every 130 years. But it's probably been around the sun hundreds or maybe even thousands of times. And it's now scattered dust all around its orbit. So although the comet's long gone, won't be back for another century, the dust is what we plow through when we get to this point in our orbit. So we'd always get to the same point in space on the same date, roughly, each year. So August 11th, 12th, we'll always get the Perseids. That's when we're closest to the comet's orbit and we plow through the dust cloud that's invisible otherwise that it left behind it. And there's another big meteor shower in December called the Geminids. And the same thing happens. It'll always happen in at the same month. So we can predict the meteor showers pretty accurately. The weather is not so easy.
And as you said, you did see the Swift Tuttle comet because you had a telescope. The wonderful thing about the Perseids is they're very visible with the naked eye. You don't need, I mean, obviously, if you have a telescope, if you have binoculars, by all means, use them. But you don't need them. You will see them with the naked eye standing in your garden, hopefully.
Now, in fact, leave the binoculars and telescopes indoors because they'll only see a tiny part of the sky, much better than your eyes will. But these meteors can streak across nearly all the sky on some occasions, and certainly a good chunk of it, more than a pair of binoculars would pick up. So human eyesight is all you need. And that's why if people go to our website, you can see we're asking people to count how many meteors they see every 15 minutes. That has real scientific value. We'll be publishing a big report in the magazine. So if you go to astronomy.ie, you'll see the Perseid page. It'll tell you, I'll give you an example. The counts are very easy. Tell us where you were, 11 to 11:15, saw 27 meteors. Simple as that. And if you watch another 15 minutes and stay up even until dawn, just one line for each 15-minute period, and you've got a fantastic piece of citizen science. So we'd really encourage people to get involved in that. The magazine's aimed at the general public, kids and families. So it's non-technical reports that we're looking for. And during all that watching, you'll probably see some of those huge fireballs. The front cover of our magazine, I think it was 2 years ago now, had an amazing one when a photographer just happened to be pointing his camera at the right place at the right time. This fireball that I actually saw light up the sky from behind me. I didn't turn around quick enough to see it, but he got a brilliant photograph of it.
And as we say, hopefully we are getting clear spells in the earlier part of the night at least, and it'll get a bit murkier as the night goes on. But hopefully, as you say, there'll be enough clear weather, if not in the northwest, certainly down the country. I'm sure you and your colleagues will be out in force on high ground in the Wicklow Hills or Dublin Mountains or wherever to try and get the best view possible.
Yeah, well, we want people all over the 32 counties, you know, from Donegal to Kerry, to be out there watching it. Someone's bound to get a clear sky. It always happens, especially when we have things like eclipses and other events that happen at a very specific time. This meteor shower not only happening tonight, we expect about 20 times more shooting stars than normal tonight. But we'll get half that tomorrow night, which is 10 times more, good show, and half that, 5 times more, on Wednesday night.
Yeah.
So you've got several nights where you're going to see a lot more meteors this week than normal. And we want people to send in their counts, because it's only the general public counting these that tells us this one in August, the one in December, are the strongest meteor showers. And they can vary by maybe 50% year to year. So we don't know whether this is going to be exceptionally good or one of the slightly poorer performances, hopefully the former. And you know, there's lots more happening in the sky as well. At dawn, if that aurora doesn't last till the morning, well, at least you can see a double planet of Mars and Jupiter all this week. And next month, there's going to be an eclipse. October has a huge comet coming. November has Venus in evening skies. And December has Mars in the sky, along with the Christmas star that we're expecting. So mm-hmm. we always pack the pages of Astronomy Ireland with things to see. And there's a big barbecue at the end of the month as well. If people want to look through giant telescopes, we'll point them for them. You'll see details on the website.
Right. David Moore, thank you very much indeed. That's the annual Perseachar. It's tonight and tomorrow night and into Wednesday night as well, although the law of decreasing returns does apply in this one. Hopefully we'll get sufficient clear skies to get some really good sights. But David, for the moment, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
And it's always our pleasure to speak to you as well. That's David Moore there from Astronomy Ireland. Now, let's look at a few of your comments. In fact, no, before we do comments, let's do the quiz. Give the quiz a final rattle on the programme this morning, because this is Heritage Week from today until the 16th of August. And on the show today, we have two family heritage cards valued at €90 each to give away. The cards offer free access for one family with two adults and up to five children over 12 to over 45 OPW-managed heritage sites across the country. You can visit any or all the attractions as often as you like during the validity period of the card. heritageweek.ie for all details. To win, simply answer the following clue, and we're looking for the name of a heritage site in Donegal. High above Burt, this fort has found fame as dramatic as the theatre that also bears its name. High above Burt, this fort has found fame as dramatic as the theatre that also bears its name. Please text or WhatsApp your answer, name and address, to 086 60 25000. And before the show is over, we'll be able to bring you the results of that particular quiz marking Heritage Week. Now, also just want to mention that due to the filming of a TV project, Hattrick Productions have been granted two road closures this week near Clonmany. At the Mamor Gap Grotto on Wednesday 14th and Friday 16th of August from 7am to 7pm, and on Thursday on the Clonmany to Clonduff Road from 7am to 7pm. So Mamor Gap Grotto on Wednesday and Friday, and Clonmany to Clonduff Road on Thursday. Roads closed there from 7am to 7pm, and that is to facilitate a project which is filming in that particular area. Going to take a short break. Back in a moment for a discussion about social housing in the Glenties electoral area. Into the final 28 minutes of the 9 till noon show today. Just before we go for a quick discussion on social housing, just a few comments. A lot of engagement on the issue of children not getting their game with local sports clubs. Caller says, is this still going on? Same when our son was at Gaelic and soccer too. He eventually left. Very sad for the young people. Another caller says that this issue was raised on Letterkenny Babies recently, and hundreds of parents had similar issues with local clubs in Donegal. Caller says Putin's been alleging all along that NATO and the US were out to cancel Russia, and that they've been trying to do this secretly for many years. Within the past few days, the Ukrainian army, supplied with heavy NATO and US weapons, have invaded Russia and are threatening to take control of a Russian nuclear plant. So what might I be missing? Who's telling the truth? Another caller says, all of the money that went to Ukraine was to defend Ukraine from Russia. Now Zelensky has moved into Russia. We paid for defence, not offence. What is going on? Ukrainians will argue that this is part ultimately of a defensive move, and that they have no wish to take over parts of Russia, but they are questions that are being raised. Now, let's go to the Glenties electoral area, and specifically to the Dolman Centre and Conall Shovlin, who is there. Always good to talk to you, Conall. Good morning.
Good morning, Donald.
Conal, we're talking about social housing, and in particular, you believe that in smaller areas like the Glenties local electoral area, municipal district, there is a need for a different model of housing than perhaps is used in Letterkenny. And one of the things that the council and government need to do is start looking at being imaginative as to what to do in those smaller areas.
Yeah, well, in the past, in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of once-off houses built by the council, you know, on farmers' land and that. For a farmer might have been in need of housing, or some neighbour might have been in need of housing, and they bought a site and they built it, a house there. But that's sort of over now, you know. But we looked at 18 months ago at the Dolman Centre, because a lot of communities say that a community centre nearly should be there before a housing scheme, you know. So we looked at a site just that's 5 minutes from the Dolman Centre, a very good site, and for a small project, maybe 6 or 8 houses. And we approached a lot of the housing trusts, you know, the larger housing trusts, but they're really concentrating on the bigger centres of population, and they deal more with maybe 20 to 30 houses. And then there's the other aspect of it. There's a lot of situations where the council tender out for turnkey projects for social housing. Mm-hmm. But the problem is in areas like here where you're building 6 or 8 houses, I mean, you have smaller contractors maybe that they would need about 2 million of working capital to face into a project like that, even for 6 houses over maybe 18 months or 2 years. And then you take the interest and then of 100,000 on top of that, and buying the site and getting planning. So these smaller contractors, you know, are prohibited from that type of, because if they were borrowing money, they would be paying 7 or 8% for it, but the council borrow money at 1.5% on the government balance sheet. So it's it's a model I think that the council need to look at for smaller rural areas, that they're just proactive in building the 4 or 6
effectively
houses,
then,
you know.
Effectively, are you saying that the council and the developers should get together, and the council should effectively pre-fund the developers so that the job gets done? Because there is potentially one issue there I can see from the council's point of view, and I'm just going to put this to you. The council could well be worried that if they start front-loading and paying up front for developments, do we get into a situation where suddenly it becomes a blank check and the costs rise, and the council finds itself pumping in more and more and more money?
No, I mean, why should that happen? I mean, if the big developers that have access to a lot of working capital and all that can do them projects, and they can do turnkey, and the housing trusts have access to the money too from the Department of Environment and the council for doing all that. But you're not going to get big operators coming into small rural areas like here, like, you know. So, I mean, if you look at the school here, I mean, there was 140 at the school 25 years ago, you know, and there's 62 at it today. You need young people in the area, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
And the jobs are not here to get big loans and all that. So you have to be imaginative with the people that are looking for the houses and the community, and say, what can we all put in place to make this thing work? And, I mean, if you have facilities like a good community centre and a church and a pub, and you have a good beach 5 minutes away, and, like, you know, when people want to live there, but it's not possible. Now, we've been at it a year and a half now looking at Housing Trust, and we've met them about coming here, but these projects they're not big enough, and they're far away from bigger centres of population. And then bigger developers that are doing turnkey jobs are not going to look at small projects like that. So
have you had discussions directly with the council with regards to what might
possibly be done? I'm involved in community development the last 55 years, so I'm kind of torturing people all the time, you know, about how maybe we can do things and come out with a successful conclusion. But now I believe, like, that in a case like this where you say smaller, you know, you have to younger contractors coming along too in areas like rural areas, but they cannot possibly finance something like that without the assistance of the council. Because again, I mean, if the council are borrowing money at 1.5% and a small developer is borrowing it at 7 or 8, it can't be done. And they're going to have 2 years interest before they even get started, and then they have to buy the site and they have to go for planning, whereas the council would have a lot of in-house things, like they would view a site and they would look at the planning, and, you know, it would be joined up thinking for them to do smaller projects, like, because I don't think they'll be done in small areas like here unless something like that is done.
At the risk of sounding pedantic, it stops being a turnkey project, though, doesn't it, as soon as the council is putting in money up front? Because the idea of turnkey is Donegal County Council reaches an agreement with the developer that you will provide we'll say for the sake of argument, 20 houses, and we will pay you, to pluck a figure off the top of my head, we will pay you 3 million euro. And those figures could be further out than Fannet Lighthouse, but I'll just use those figures as indicative figures. So the council says to the developer, you deliver us 20 houses, we'll give you 3 million euro, and the houses are developed, the houses are finished, the money is handed over, and the council, as the name suggests, the council takes the keys and passes them on to tenants. That's the theory of how that system works. If you're coming into a situation where the council and smaller developers are working together with the council pre-funding a project that's going to be done by the developer, you're then moving into a different thing where the council and the developer are in partnership. Now, maybe there is an argument that says that's what we need to be getting into.
Yeah, but I mean, what you're doing is, as Cardinal's work's going on,
yeah,
you are paying for that work on a quantity surveyor's bill of estimates. Yeah. So there's nobody out anything, and there's nobody. I mean, when we built the Dolman Centre 26 years ago, I mean, we had to spend money before we got the grants in for what we were doing, and with the bank in Ardra that time, the Ulster Bank was very good in providing us sort of was the working capital that the grants would flow on then. But it's a different world now out there. I mean, you don't have banks now doing that type of thing, because the bank manager had total discretion at that time of working with a local person doing that. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that anymore. And I mean, if you have a contractor, say, and they're doing their work and it's examined at different times that there's so much money spent now and the money then goes to the contractor as he's doing the work. I mean, I don't see why that... There's nobody out anything, you know, and if it's an overall contract that starts off, like, it's. But as I say,
is there
I think
scope
these
for the government?
Won't be done in small communities.
Yeah. Is there potentially scope then for the government to provide the loans?
Well, the government and the council work together.
The government and the council provide the loans
able to
the.
Borrow it,
obviously, you can only do that in a situation where there's an absolute cast iron guarantee that the houses, when finished, are going to become social housing. Because if that were done once, and then those houses went on to the general market for sale, then there'd be all sorts of potential issues about other developers who had to pay 7% on the mortgage for their private developments would be claiming that, you know, it was unfair competition, and, you know, you're going down potentially a number of very complicated roads with that. So there would have to be guarantees on price, guarantees on cost, and guarantees on the ultimate fate of the houses, that they would go into public use as rental properties administered by the council. And if a formula can be found to do that, then it may well be in the future.
You're not going to build any houses unless you have a demand, an applicant there that wants a house, and the community works with that applicant and the council works with that applicant. Yeah. There has to be an element of trust in the whole thing, you know, if people want the houses. But, I mean, as I go back to my original point, in the 70s and 80s, you go all over the whole country, Donegal. There are individual houses built by the council on farmers' land, and even at times the council bought the site of a farmer to build a house for somebody that had no land. But that is not happening anymore. Yeah. So if you're looking at small rural communities like ours, then you have to come up with a new sort of template as to how it can be done. Not like Letterkenny or Donegal Town, where they're growing, you know, and big developers can come in there and do that, whether it's housing trusts or whether they're turnkey projects. So you have to have something different for small rural communities that's located all over Donegal, where you maybe have a church and a pub and a community centre at a crossroads, you know, and people want to live there.
Yeah, well, we know that Donegal County Council is having monthly special meetings to discuss housing, and it's certainly an issue, I'm sure, would be put on the agenda. And Conley, it certainly is food for thought. I'm conscious that there are a number of issues, and I know indeed there are at least two instances that I can think of at the moment where there are ongoing discussions between the council and developers and voluntary housing organisations about projects which are complete but are not in use as of yet, because there are issues over costs and issues over money, and there are various issues. And I can think of at least two situations in the county where that's an issue. And that's why I'm saying that for such a scheme like this to work, it would have to be based very much on cast iron guarantees and deals between the council, the government, voluntary housing agencies and the developer. And we would have to find a formula that makes sure that the issues that are being experienced in a few other places, you know, are not experienced into the future.
But if you think of all the negatives, you'll end up doing nothing. You won't get out of bed in the morning.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. But you have to learn from the past.
You have to learn from the past and work around something that appears sensible and practical. Mm-hmm. I mean, the site that we are offered, for instance, I mean, it's a wonderful site at a very cheap price.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just 2 minutes from the Dolman Centre and 5 minutes from Yarn Beach. And as I said, it was a school going down from 142 to 62. If you're having young people coming there, and if they can't afford to build a house, then you have to provide an alternative. Whatever system that is, and I'm not saying if it's turnkey jobs or if it's a housing trust coming in, it's just that in the past 18 months or 2 years that I've spent talking and ringing and cajoling people to see what the housing trust come in there, but I've given up on it, you know. And after two years, my years are kind of valuable now, you know, as you get older. So, I mean, but this is what I'm on saying that we need a different template for these small rural communities to work to build houses. Yeah. And it has to be interacting with the community, with the people that want them, with everybody involved in it, you know.
Well, what I would love to see, Conal, what I would love to see is for you to be invited to one of those special meetings of Donegal County Council and make a presentation to that effect, either to Glendale's Municipal District, but actually, no, even bypass the MD. Go straight to one of the special housing meetings in Lifford and make a presentation. Yeah. I would love to see that happen, because maybe what needs to happen at those special council meetings is for people like yourself to come in with those fresh ideas and, you know, present them. Because, I mean, this needs to be heard, obviously, by those in the corridors of power who understand better than me, certainly, how this thing works.
You know, you might think maybe me on the radio to you, my ideas are crazy, but I think there's a big thing written at Kennedy Airport, New York, for the former John F. Kennedy said, "Don't ask are my ideas crazy, ask are they crazy enough."
Yeah. Back in the days when there was an airfield called Idlewild, if I recall correctly. Yeah.
I mean, we get stuck on conventional things all the time. We're afraid to move. We shouldn't be afraid to move if we think that's a good move, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes rules and regulations are written, and they're written, and we're afraid then to drift anyway from that. Because at the end of the day, we're all dealing with people and humanity at the end of the day, you know. It's an all-inclusive thing, and that's why I'm on the radio side to see, can something be put in place just for a small community that progresses into the future, you know.
As I say, Conal, it is certainly an interesting one, and I would absolutely, as I say, it would be really good to have a presentation to that effect made to Donegal County Council. But as you say, there is a contradiction that if the investor goes to borrow, it's 7%. And if the council is borrowing for public housing, it's 1.1%. So, I mean, if that gap can be bridged, we'd be a long way down the road towards perhaps making
a long way,
more attractive.
But I think that's not good. I don't think that doesn't happen if you go to the banks now. Say a small contractor goes to the banks and has that idea of doing that, and very conscientious, and he's trying to build up his business.
Yeah.
I mean, 7 or 8% is... And 2 years then, 100,000 of interest on top of that, and buy the site and go for planning. You know, it's not viable in a small community, and that's why I'm saying we want a different model, you know.
Well, that's perhaps another thing as well, is there's a lot of talk about reviewing the planning process and improving the planning process. And I listened to a national podcast featuring a former minister, Ivan Yates, and this is one thing he's talking about an awful lot, is that one of the biggest constrictions and constraints to housing developments at this moment is the planning situation, and that should be streamlined and made a lot easier, because it's almost...
Well, also for small projects like that, the council have in-house planning, you know. I mean, they have in-house, they can do it in-house without putting the pressure on some small developers. It's at risk of putting in a costly planning application, you know.
And they do it through Part A
or
whatever.
It's joined up thinking, really, you know. It's joined up thinking from everybody's point of view.
More cooperation between the council and the contractors. Let's see where this goes, Colin.
Yeah, and the other thing is that contractors are getting scarce, and you have to nurture new, younger contractors to come into the field.
Absolutely.
And you have to have, you know, models of housing that fits them.
Well, certainly food for thought. Conal, thanks for speaking to us. And we'll be
looking
with interest
time.
To see where it goes. Conal, thank you. That's Conal Shufflin there speaking to us from the Dolman Centre in Nairnport New. And that's Conal's basic point that, you know, it's getting harder and harder to get turnkey developments in a small area like that. And as he said, with the numbers going to the local school almost halved in the past couple of years, and that's a situation we're seeing replicated right across Donegal. So certainly food for thought. It's an interesting one. Going to take a short break. Back after the... Like me, many of you were watching the closing ceremony from the Olympics last night in the Stade de France in Paris. I'm delighted to say that I can now speak to Teresa McDade, who is the manager of the Irish athletics team at the Olympic Games in Paris. They've just arrived in Dublin, looking forward to a big event at the GPO in just under an hour. So, Teresa, great to talk to you, and welcome home.
Thank you very much, and very glad to be home, I have to say.
Teresa, people talking that this was the most successful Olympics for Ireland ever. And, I mean, when it comes to the athletics team that you are the manager of, perhaps the greatest compliment you can play that team is if 10 years ago an Irish team were to get into a 4x400 metre relay, or an Irish athlete were to get into the 400 metre final and came fourth, we would be declaring days off and we would say it was the greatest thing ever. The fact that that's been achieved and people are almost disappointed says so much about where the team has come, where Rashida Adeleke and her compatriots in the relay team have come, and where athletics are now. I mean, there's punching above your weight, and there's punching above your weight. I mean, in fairness, those five girls, let's not forget Kelly, who did a great job in the semis. Those five girls did such an amazing job. I mean, I'm in awe, and I think most of the country are.
Well, they absolutely, and so are we. We're so proud of them, and they literally ran out of their skins. And as you say, that's exactly where we are at. We are disappointed. And we know that we are there and we are in that category and we're looked at. And it is devastating. And such an evening, and everybody was upset, and it was very high emotional, particularly after the 4x4. And again, the next day, there was certainly, you know, it took us a little while to sort of kind of come around. I think, the next morning, although we had Fionnuala McCormack in the marathon, mm-hmm. so we had a little reprieve from a staffing point of view. But yes, exactly. Like it's world class. And again, if you look at the age of those girls, like they're all very, very young, and they're such ambassadors for athletics and for sport and for, youth in general.
And they didn't just break the Irish national record. They decimated, tore it up, and just rewrote the history book. Because, I mean, I heard a statistic on national radio yesterday, and they were saying that the Irish record has gone from something like 326 to 319 in the space of just a year, or not long.
Even in months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like for, and Rome, like, which is only just so recently, the girls had to up their game by 2 seconds almost to actually medal and from their record that they had done 3 weeks previously in the world relays, and they've come out and done the same again, and you know, it just augurs so well for what's coming. The splits that everybody looks at for each girl, I just can't wait to see what they're actually going to do individually, but when they come out to run again individually, and then when every individual is running very, very well, the team looks after itself. So yeah, I think we'll have an exciting next 4-year cycle ahead of us.
Oh, absolutely.
And, hopefully we can. And again, you take the likes of Rashida, you take the likes of, like, don't forget Kieran McGeehan, unfortunately got injured. Yeah. Kieran McGeehan was fourth in, Budapest in the World Championships last year. You know, so, and again, from, you know, the overall team Ireland have done amazingly well. And again, our stats are all up. We have more finalists, we have more top 16, more top 24 than Tokyo. So whilst there's a better suite, I suppose, is the best way to say it. We are, of course, disappointed and want more, but yet we're extremely proud, and we are, moving along nicely in the long-term process of it all.
A lot of talk from the politicians about increased funding for sport and for Olympics in particular, talk of up to 500 million being provided over the next 4 years. In terms of the funding, it's vital that that continues, that the elite athletes get the support that they need to continue developing. You'll be watching very carefully, I'm sure, how that funding is dispersed and organised over
Absolutely.
The coming
Absolutely, of course,
months.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, you know, in terms we have a strategic plan. And there's things we really want to do. There's things we know that if we could do them, that will improve. It'll make that difference between where we are now and just getting that across the line. So, and I do think it's amazing as well. The whole country is behind us and behind athletics particularly. And, I'm looking forward to some positive news at the next announcement in terms of funding.
Teresa, enjoy the homecoming, and I hope the athletes do. It should be an absolutely fantastic day and a fantastic few days, and no one deserves it more than yourselves and the team. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. They're just literally walking out here now, so you're having it live here now from Dublin Airport. They're literally walking out onto the crowd, so yeah, fantastic. Well, thanks
I'm sure
very
they're
much.
Getting the reception they deserve. Thank you. That's Teresa McDay. They're the manager of the Irish athletics team, a native of this fair county, and it's great to hear all that. Now, the Heritage Week quiz, Heritage Week next week, and we've been giving away family passes from the OPW, and our winners today are Dultoch Bonner, Ashley Close in Letterkenny, and also Rosemary Gallagher in Drumkeen. Both among the many people who correctly identified the location of our little cryptic clue. High above Bort, this fort has found fame as dramatic as the theatre that also bears its name. The theatre, of course, on Greenon in Letterkenny. And the answer is the Greenon of Alia. And congratulations to the winners. Just one or two comments before we go. A man applied to build houses on Bort. Plinola objected to him twice after a neighbour objected. A neighbour didn't want him to make money. How do people expect houses if people are always objecting? And Caller says, loyalists have also always cozied up to the English racist elements, such as the National Front, who were anti-Irish civil rights, BNP, etc. The political right, including the Irish Blue Shirts, have been traditionalist, etc. Loyalist areas have also always been racist, as sectarianism is a form of racism. Also, loyalist areas are where the cheaper, empty houses are located. So Catholics, knowing those areas, avoid them, whilst non-nationals, not aware of how those areas operate, being policed by paramilitaries, are moving into the areas. Some are even Catholic Poles. The deprivation of these areas, the lack of the sectarian-appointed work, and extremely poor local and national leadership, based on an orange ideology that is sectarian and an anti-culture based on reaction to Catholicism, has created this hotbed of riotous reaction to housing non-nationalists, fleeing war, famine, etc., often controlled by paramilitaries and drug dealers who want to keep control of places like Sandy Row, Tigers Bay, etc. So says a caller, and thank you very much indeed for your comment. And that's it from the Lines of the Noon Show. It's been a pleasure presenting for the day today. John Breslin is up next around the Northwest. Thank you very much indeed to Shannon, and especially to Caroline, who produced. And most importantly, thank you to all our participants, all our guests, and thank you to you for listening. For myself, Donal Kavanagh, have a great day.